This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The future of the McLean County Democratic Party is up for grabs heading into one of the most exciting local election seasons in years.
We can bridge this gap between what the Democratic Party has been and what many of us want it to be as we look forward.
Jill Blair and other Democrats talk about bringing together the old guard and new faces, hoping to create a permanent shift in McLean County politics. GLT's Ryan Denham has the story. Hear an NPR report about gun measures being debated in Springfield. The call for more gun control following the Parkland High School shooting is being heard in Illinois. And GLT's Laura Kennedy talks with the Sight Geeks about Black Panther and what the highly successful movie is delivering to audiences. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's March 1st, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Bernie versus Hillary struggle is long over, but the fight for the future of the Democratic Party still rages. In McLean County, Democrats are riding high, energized by President Trump's election and with more candidates on the ballot. But they're also looking for a new leader, one who may change the direction of the party. GLT's Ryan Denham reports the future of the McLean County Democratic Party began 14 months ago.
That's when more than 100 Democrats crowded into a Bloomington Union Hall on a Thursday night. It was December 1st, 2016, and many were still in shock over the recent election of Donald Trump. They talked about how Trump lost Bloomington Normal but still won the county overall. But they mostly focused on the future, breaking into small groups to talk about fundraising and candidate recruitment and filling open precinct committeeman posts.
The room was full. The energy was just pulsating. I think there was a sense of, oh my, what do we do now?
That's Sally Pancrazio, a Democratic precinct committeeman from Bloomington.
And so it's a very exciting time with all that new energy.
It was a turning point for the party, one that Democrats hope will lead to electoral victories in November. And they'll do that under new leadership, with longtime party chair John Penn not seeking re-election in April, opening a three-way race for his successor. Amid one of the most exciting local election seasons in years, that new chair will have to juggle tricky internal politics. Most importantly, how to meld the party's union-backed old guard with an influx of new progressive faces. Democrats say the goal is to convert this temporary anti-Trump energy into a more permanent shift in McLean County politics. Jill Blair of Bloomington is one of many first-time women candidates who turned their post-Trump shock into action. She's challenging Republican State Representative Keith Sommer in the 88th House District.
I think it's important that we don't lose sight of the past as well. We can bridge this gap between what the Democratic Party has been and what many of us want it to be as we look forward.
There are three candidates to succeed Penn. Dorothy Deeney, Penn's number two and current party co-chair, Eric Rankin, a McLean County board member with campaign expertise, and Patrick Cortese, a progressive founder of the local Indivisible Movement. Each would have a different approach to bringing together the party's factions. That includes unions, historically the base of the party, and newer entrants such as progressive activists, women, independents, and issue-oriented voters, groups like the Stonewall Democrats and the Democratic Socialists of America, and collegiate Democrats, just to name a few. Here's Pancrazio.
Our new chair has to be able to work with all those diverse groups, welcome them, hear them, reflect on their concerns and issues, and then bring us all together in a way that forms our action agenda. I know it sounds like I kind of want a Superman or a Wonder Woman or a Black Panther coming in as our new chair, but I do think those who have announced that they're running and others in our group either have those traits or they certainly have the potential to develop them.
Not long ago, McLean County Democrats weren't so energized. Yes, there have been some smaller successes, like home state Senator Barack Obama winning McLean County during his first presidential run in 2008. Two-term Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner is a Democrat. But mostly, McLean County has been red. Republicans hold a 15-5 majority in the county board. All countywide elected officials are Republicans. All locally elected state lawmakers are Republicans, including the Senate Minority Leader. Unlike downstate metro areas, Peoria and Champaign-Urbana, there are no Democratic state representatives here. Until recently, monthly party meetings would routinely draw only about a dozen people. As recently as the 2012 primary, less than 12% of all voters pulled a Democratic ballot. And from 2014 to 2016, more than three-quarters of Democratic precinct and committeeman posts, those valuable foot soldiers who make up the party's base, were vacant. Democrats also lag in fundraising, at least at the party level. The McLean County Republican Central Committee has raised $91,000 in contributions since 2015. The Democrats have received just $45,000.
I've lived here long enough to remember the comment, "Oh, McLean County Democrats, you're the group that can meet in a phone booth."
That's Democrat George Gordon, a McLean County board member and retired Illinois State University professor.
Well, now we're up to at least four or five phone booths. Actually, in reality, well beyond that.
Penn has been chair since 1984, steering the party through ups and downs. By his own admission, Penn says he's been less hands-on in recent years since taking a job as vice president and Midwest regional manager with the Laborers International Union of North America, or LIUNA. That's left leadership to Deeney, who Penn calls the backbone of the party, as well as unofficial leaders like Mike Matika.
Right time probably would have been 2 years ago, or even maybe 10 years ago, as I took a new position with the Laborers International, and I've been on the road so much, I just don't have the time, and I'm not in town enough to really be a county chairman. I'm probably out of town 3-4 days a week now.
Penn's day job has at times limited the party's ability to communicate. He's difficult to schedule for media interviews, for example. Gordon says communication is key.
All three candidates are aware of the need to improve communication. I think they may have a somewhat different approach to how they're going to do that.
Rankin says this vocal Democratic leadership is key. He says liberals in McLean County have always been a little bit shy, unlike conservatives.
So we have to make people feel comfortable that that word isn't dirty. It's not wrong. It is absolutely acceptable for a person to espouse their liberal views in McLean County.
Democratic fortunes began to change quickly after Trump's election. Democrats nearly swept the election from normal township positions in April 2017. That same night, Kimberly Cummings became the first black candidate elected to the nonpartisan Normal Town Council. She is now running for Democratic Precinct Committeeman. The McLean County Democratic Party took some steps to seize this energy and influx of potential candidates. The party paid for six women to attend a one-day ready-to-run candidate recruitment and training program at Western Illinois University, part of the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers. The result? 11 of 13 county government races will be contested in November, far more than usual. Longtime Republican State Representatives Dan Brady and Keith Sommer will face their first general election opponents in several years. The 41-year-old Blair, the Democrat who's challenging Sommer, says her generation got complacent.
And we got to a certain point that we took things for granted and thought, well, we've made progress on women's rights. We've made progress on racial justice. We've made progress on LGBTQ issues and so many others. And we thought, well, there's no going back. The election of 2016 was proof to all of us that you really can move backwards on this. And as you make progress, you need to stand up and defend it.
Internal Democratic Party politics, think Bernie versus Hillary, are playing out all across the country, not just here. In California, longtime U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein recently lost her party's endorsement, a sign that grassroots Democrats are eager to supplant leaders who are seen as too moderate and willing to compromise. In Chicago, conservative Democrat Congressman Dan Lipinski faces a stiff primary challenge from his left. This tension exists in McLean County, too. Democratic candidate for governor Daniel Biss has won the support of many local progressives, including the endorsement of the ISU Democrats. But Penn has played host several times to Biss's chief rival, J.B. Pritzker. The Illinois Democratic County Chairman's Association, of which Penn is a member, endorsed Pritzker last fall. Rankin says the tent needs to be big.
A party that needs to be successful can't alienate one over the other. You can't look at one and say, well, they're not Democrat enough. We have to be able, I kind of look at it like, and a lot of times like a dysfunctional family, right? Everybody's got that brother or sister or a crazy uncle that they're a little out of bounds in terms of how the rest of the family is, but they're still family and they're still necessary in order to make the family effective and successful.
Patrick Cortese has only become active in the Democratic Party last year. He says his unique voice and vision for where we need to go as a party sets him apart.
I think we need to get back to talking about our values. I think we need to make sure that people in McLean County feel included and part of the process.
Pancrazio, the precinct committeeman, says the party needs to accommodate younger, independent-minded voters.
They are more issue-oriented than party-oriented. They need to be respected, and we need to listen to them, and we need to come together on an area of common good for all of us.
McLean County Democrats have long been associated with organized labor, itself not a monolith. Penn's dual roles has only reinforced that. The relationship is personal, financial, and practical. Records show that unions have transferred into or contributed $18,000 to the McLean County Democratic Party since 2016, more than half of all incoming money. Many party events are held at local union halls. Here's Gordon, a longtime local Democrat.
I know some folks who felt that by not being part of the labor movement, they didn't feel that they were being made a part of the local Democratic Party. I don't know that that's fair. I don't know that that's accurate, but that's how they felt.
And yet, Gordon says the new chair can't turn away from the party's union roots.
It is very important that organized labor in McLean County feels that with a change in direction of the party leadership, that they aren't being left behind or in any way excluded or having their role diminished. There may be some diminishing just because John Penn isn't going to be the chair anymore, but some change is inevitable.
Deanie, the longtime co-chair, says she'd work to keep the party united, welcoming new faces while not turning away from unions. She says it's important to honor traditions like the party's annual Roosevelt and Baldini dinners.
I don't want to see all of the old guard go by the wayside without having a chance to share some of the information that we do have.
Rankin says he too wants to maintain union relationships, though he wants to broaden that to include more workers from local universities and schools. He says groups like Black Lives Matter, Voices of Reason, and Indivisible are part of the Democratic tent too.
They're just as important as unions.
If anti-Trump sentiment is the fuel that sparked this Democratic resurgence, party officials seem aware that it's not an unlimited power supply. One day, Trump will no longer be president. And what happens if Democrats don't do as well as expected in November? Will those who lose leave politics again? If elected chair, Rankin says he'd focus on giving all those new faces something to do, committees to join, events to run, and other ways to be active. That builds a bench of potential candidates for races like school board or county board.
And that's one of the things that we've really struggled with here in McLean County is that the Democrats don't have we have traditionally not had a bench to build from.
Deanie says she wants to see the party broaden and diversify its executive committee. That four-person group today skews older than many of the party's newer faces. By contrast, the McLean County Republican Party has several 20 and 30-somethings on its executive committee. The next chair also needs to build up the party's fundraising operation, especially to support women candidates who historically have a harder time raising money. That's according to Billy Strippick, president of ISU's College Democrats. He says they'll also have to continue building the ranks of Democratic precinct committeemen.
And a strong precinct committeeman structure is something that will kind of keep the party afloat, even in years that might lean more towards the Republican Party.
The ISU and Illinois Wesleyan Democrats have endorsed Rankin as chair, whose campaign experience includes a master's degree in campaign political management from George Washington University. He's also served 3 terms on the Republican-led McLean County Board, though he's not seeking re-election so he can run for chair. Strippick wants that experience.
Most importantly, in 2018, the Democratic Party finally has a lot of choices on the ballot for the first time in a while, and I think that it's going to take a lot of guidance and a lot of experience in electoral politics in order to kind of guide the Democratic Party to victory in 2018.
The county's demographics as an urban college town surrounded by rural voters may be changing in the Democrats' favor. It's becoming more diverse. The county added 22,000 residents between 2000 and 2016, but the percentage of those who are white has dropped from 89% to 84%. White rural voters are more likely to vote Republican. Trump narrowly won the county as a whole, but he lost Bloomington Normal, where the bulk of voters live. In 2008, Obama won Bloomington Normal precincts with 54% of the vote over Republican John McCain, despite only winning the county overall by 900 votes. Here's Gordon's read on where the county is headed politically.
I think the county is trending certainly away from rock-ribbed Republican. The default setting is that it's still going to be Republican. Bloomington and Normal, maybe not. People sort of quote unquote out in the county, they're not going to pay attention to a campaign. Their default setting may be I'm going to vote Republican unless I have real good reason not to. But maybe there will be real good reason not to sometime.
As Democrats change, their opponents aren't standing still. On the right, the McLean County GOP will be selecting a new chair as well in April to replace Chuck Erickson, who's not seeking a third term. And the McLean County Libertarian Party, appearing on local ballots for the first time this year, may go after voters who are liberal on social issues like marijuana legalization. Penn says he's eager to see what happens next.
We'll just see what direction the party goes, but they've got a good foundation with the current precinct committee people, the new people that's coming into the party look like they're very active, more than willing to work hard. And so I think it's going to be pretty exciting for the Democrats here in the next several years.
I'm Ryan Denham.
To find more election news, join GLT's new Facebook group. Just search for Election 2018 in McLean County to join the conversation. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up during Sound Ideas, it's an edition of Grow. Laura Kennedy and Patrick Murphy talk dirt about soil. That's ahead during Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Central Illinois Regional Airport is reviving an effort to add an airport tax to rural McLean County. Democratic State Representative Jay Hoffman has introduced a measure to widen the tax base for the airport from just Bloomington Normal. Central Illinois Regional Airport Director Carl Olson tells GLT's Charlie Schlenker the goal is to create a more dependable and locally controlled revenue stream. Olson says the Quad Cities, Rockford, and Bloomington Normal Airport authorities are part of the legislation, and he says it's not a new idea.
Similar to steps taken by the Peoria, DuPage, and Crawford County airports in the past years, our three airports are working through the legislative process to effect this change in order to accomplish three objectives.
What are they?
The first objective is to create a more dependable and locally controlled revenue stream for airport operating and capital project needs, which enhances the authority's contingency and long-term planning capability. The second objective is to provide a more effective toolbox to enhance CIRA's competitive positioning in order to better attract and retain new aviation and non-aviation investment, economic development, and job growth. And lastly, to provide tax equity and equality for all the taxpayers in the community. It should be noted the entire community should equally support the airport, just as the entire community equally benefits from the economic contribution of the airport.
Why define McLean County as the community, then, instead of just Bloomington Normal?
Because what's interesting is when you look at the data, the airport, CIRA annually generates in excess of $165 million of economic output. We support directly and indirectly more than 1,200 jobs in the community, with an annual payroll exceeding $46 million. Now, what's really interesting, Charlie, when you look at that, is the financial benefit of the airport does not stop at Bloomington or Normal's municipal boundary. In fact, a quick survey of a group of airport employees here, and not just airport authority employees, but all airport employees, reveals that 40% of these families earning paychecks live outside of Bloomington and Normal. So as I said, the economic benefit of the airport doesn't stop at the municipal boundaries.
This is not the first time for this proposal. How is this bill different from ones in past years?
The difference now is that we're working in partnership with the Quad Cities Airport Authority and the Chicago-Rockford Airport Authority. And the three community airports are doing this in unison.
Why Jay Hoffman, State Representative Jay Hoffman, as the sponsor for this, as opposed to a local lawmaker?
Well, last year we were not able to generate a local sponsor for the bill, you might recall. Mr. Hoffman is just an introductory sponsor. Actually, we are working with the other airports, Quad Cities and Rockford, about attracting sponsorships from their community, as well as reaching out to legislators from our community and asking for their support of the same bill.
Are you looking for support from lawmakers in marketplaces that already have countywide tax bases for their airports as well?
You know, at this point, we're simply looking for sponsors and co-sponsors for the bill from the three communities involved.
What are its prospects statewide once you have those sponsors?
I don't know. We're certainly going to work through the legislature. We're going to advocate for this bill. We believe it has good merits to stand on its own. I think the merits were very good last year, and the merits are better now that there's other communities involved looking for the same opportunity for support.
What would it do to property tax rates for the Bloomington Normal area proper?
One important note, this is not about generating additional revenue. This is about contingency planning and competitive positioning and moving forward in a stronger fashion. Looking at the local tax rates right now, as I said, this is not about generating more revenue. In fact, the Airport Authority is interested in reducing the corporate rate. Right now, that is at 4 cents per $100 of assessed value. Our figures estimate that that would go down about 30% to about 2.8 cents per $100 of assessed value. So the members and the residents of Bloomington and Normal would actually see a 30% reduction in their property taxes they pay to the Airport Authority, while residents in rural McLean County who currently do not pay a tax to the Airport Authority would have a new tax of approximately $41 per year per $150,000 valued home.
What is the current tax for Bloomington Normal for a $150,000 home, and what would it drop to?
Right now it is $68, and it would go down to about $47. So it's about a $20 savings.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker, talking with Carl Olson, the director of the Central Illinois Regional Airport. Do you care to contrast your share of the tax pie with any other taxing bodies for contextual purposes?
Well, I think we're different from other taxing bodies. Let me give you an example. When the Airport Authority was generated or created in 1964, property tax represented over 75% of the operating revenue for the airport. In the ensuing 53 years, that has gone down to 40%. And it's gone down to 40% because the Airport Authority has acted very entrepreneurially. We've identified and generated new alternate revenue streams that de-emphasize tax revenue. Unlike a school district or a city or a town or a municipality, the airport operates much more like a business in a competitive marketplace. And for that reason, the majority of our revenues come from the business operation of the airport as opposed to exclusively being tax revenue. In fact, since 2010, the Airport Authority has abated more than $7 million in tax revenue back to the taxpayers. Airport finances are strong, and this effort is not about generating new revenue or additional revenue. This is about contingency planning. This is about competitive positioning. You know, Charlie, you go back to how this got started in 2013. It was when the federal government was going to go into that sequestration phase, and they were going to eliminate funding for our tower. And you remember, we had to file suit in federal court to try to block that action and get that funding restored, and we did. But what's interesting now, you look at the Trump administration's proposed budget for fiscal year 19, and there's language in it that eliminates full and dedicated funding for contract towers again. So we have to be very careful we don't go down the same path we did in 2013. So this is not about new revenue. This is about contingency planning. This is about positioning the airport to be successful long term.
So it would be preserving existing services if federal funding is cut.
Yes, because one of the things the board came to staff with after sequestration, after contract tower funding was restored, is if this happens again, and the choice is to either close the tower or pay to have the tower stay open, how is staff going to pay for the tower? For us to be able to absorb a $700,000 expense out of the blue, well, we could, through our reserves, we could probably fund that for a year or two. But after that, we wouldn't be able to fund it. And without the tower, our air service becomes at risk. Our air cargo growth comes into play, comes into risk, and it's a safety issue as well.
If this bill passes and is signed by the governor, would there be any mid-sized municipal-based airports in the state that don't have a broader countywide tax base?
I believe so. I mean, there are other airports. It depends on their ownership structure. There are other airports. Some are airport authorities. Some are park districts. Some are university owned. Some are port districts. There's a whole range of management structures. In this case, this only pertains to three airports created under the Illinois Airport Authorities Act that are in Rockford and Quad Cities and here, exactly similar to what was done in Peoria and DuPage and Crawford County a few years ago.
What do those other communities that are bundling with you in this get out of it? Are they going into it for the same reasons, or are their reasons different?
I think there's local nuances for each of the communities, and I'm not as fluid in understanding their motivations as I am our own. But I do know in the case of Rockford, it would take the taxing jurisdiction to be countywide for Winnebago County. I have some sense of Rock Island County, where Quad Cities is located. There, they have about 18 different municipalities, and only about 7 or 8 pay taxes to the airport authority. So this would take their jurisdiction countywide to Rock Island County completely.
Do you have a Senate sponsor yet?
We are still working on sponsorships at this time.
You had approached State Senator Jason Berrickman before, and he last year said he was taking a wait and see on it. Is he still a prospect?
We hope he is. We're going to be having those conversations with Senator Berrickman. You are correct. Last year he did step away from us. We'd like to reintroduce this conversation with he and his office, and we're in the process of doing that now.
Do you have a sense whether Governor Rauner would sign such a bill, given his often stated opposition to property taxes?
I do not know that. But what I do know, in the case of McLean County, we're looking at a 30% reduction in property taxes for the residents of Bloomington and Normal, so that 75% of McLean County residents would receive a 30% tax reduction in airport taxes.
If that population base is really the controlling factor, why not just go for a referendum?
One of the reasons that the board listed or was concerned about is creating friction between the metro and rural areas of the county, that 75% of the population would receive a reduction versus 25% that would have a new tax of about $41 per year. It comes down to just creating that tension or that stress, the rural metro. And again, the chance to work with other airports in Rockford and Quad Cities to follow what's been done in DuPage and Peoria before. It worked very smoothly. And it seems to be a more efficient path to follow.
Central Illinois Regional Airport Director Carl Olson spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I'm
Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. One of the joys of spring is that first chance of the year to start digging in the dirt. But what do you really know about that stuff right under your feet? Patrick Murphy explains in this edition of GLT's Grow.
Time to get down and dirty about soil. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field. From the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences, his name is Patrick Murphy. Hello there, Murph.
Laura, how are you?
Glad to have you here, I'll tell you that. Today on GLT's Grow, Murph talks about the different types of soil and how we can get ours tested. There are different kinds of soil.
There are many different kinds of soil, and they have orders similar to the genus and species of all living things.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture has an organization that's the Natural Resource Soil Conservation Service.
That's a mouthful.
It's a mouthful. And it's an ongoing service because soil surveying has been going on since prior to 1900, and it's always changing because the environment changes, mm-hmm. the use of the land changes. Nature's reaction with rivers and rain and things like that, it changes the landscape all the time. So there are men and women that go out and they record what they find. And the soil geeks have their own language.
Really?
Yeah.
Let's hear some of that vocab.
Well, I was going to tell you that the soil taxonomy, we have this the classification of soil in 12 different soil orders, and they're in alphabetical order, and it goes from alphasols and andisols at the front of the alphabet, and at the end you've got the ultisols and vertisols.
Don't they sound like heroes from a Marvel movie?
Yeah, they're like little, they are like that. And just to kind of give you a description of this language that is kind of fascinating and funny at the same time, the alphasols that I referenced are soils that have an argillic or candic or natric nature, but have an umbric epidon. Yeah, that just rolls right off the tongue, doesn't it? I think I hurt myself. I have a talking injury now.
I have no idea what you just said.
For the record, I don't know what I just said either. I don't have a clear understanding of this language, although I do know how to speak dog quite well.
Okay, good.
But
rut-row.
Regardless, all soils have a certain percentage of sand, silt, and clay. Even within that simplest triad of understanding, if you will, there's different kinds of sand particles. There's different kinds of silt, and there are different kinds of clay particles.
This is really complicated.
It is. It's fascinating, the world that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that go out and do this, their work is never done. So I think it would have to take a certain kind of person to know that, well, I've tested that area, and by the time I retire, it will need tested again.
Wow.
And the people that test behind the people that are pioneering now, they rely off of information of the past to move forward. And that's why I think it's interesting that it's an ongoing thing. So there's some more interesting verbiage to this, right?
Mm-hmm.
There was one area here in Ford County, Illinois. We're not in Ford County, but we are in Illinois. Yeah. Well, it's called the Drummer Series. And drummers are mollisol. So that's in that A to Z type of soil orders. Well, these clever names for these various soils, the names come from all manner of things.
Yeah.
So the Drummer Series comes from a creek in Ford County near where the soil was tested. So the testers used a topographic feature to name the soil.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but there are other cases, particularly out west, right, where mm-hmm. these soil surveyors might have encountered an old or an aged gold camp, a mining camp.
Yeah.
So they tested the soil there, and what they found was some bones of a dead man. Mm-hmm. And a pan. So deadpan soil was the name that they came up
there's
with.
There's a soil called deadpan?
There's more than one, actually.
Wow.
Because you've got deadpan that's black and tilly like it is here in central Illinois. But there's another one that's filled largely with rocks and sand and only the smallest percentage of silt and clay.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, it's all the dirt on soil. And these are great, these names for soil.
There's so many nuts and bolts to the soil, and I think that's...
But it's not good to have nuts and bolts in your soil.
It's not really. You might think they'd improve drainage, but I think that they might rise to the surface every time the ground freezes. But what's important for us to know as gardeners and landscape geeks and the like,
mm-hmm.
is having to identify your soil. So you can identify it on the bird's eye view, like an eagle flying over the earth. You can identify it up at that level, and that's when you'll find out that here in central Illinois we have mollisols, and then they break down into smaller classifications all the way down to the drummer soil series, you know, kind of like in our example. But what's most helpful for gardeners to understand is the content of their soil, not so much the name. The name's neat to know.
Yeah.
And you can look this up online. It doesn't cost you a dime. But to have your soil tested to identify the percentage of nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus that's in the soil to help with a lawn, or maybe you're having soil tested to grow a garden, the soil testing gives you a benchmark, first off, and lets you know what you have. And once you know what you have, you may discover you don't need any fertilizer.
Well, tell me, how can I do this myself? Can we test our own soil, or is that something best left to the experts?
It's been set up for us by Extension, University of Illinois Extension.
Extension offices are so handy.
And it's so convenient, too, because you know it's a $20 expense to have one set of tests conducted. And if you go out to the Extension office in your area, they can even give you the envelope and the directions on how to collect the sample. We'll talk about that briefly.
Mm-hmm.
And they even give you the sample bag to send it in so you know you're not sending in too much soil.
Oh.
Right?
So okay.
Here's how we do it. Let's pretend that we have an acre of land that we want to test, and we're going to take samples off of 8 spots in this acre that are equidistant. Mm-hmm. You know, so we're going to kind of center these spots best we can on this acre. And we're going to take like a mason jar or jelly jar full of soil from each one of these spots. But we're going to throw it all in one bucket and mix it together. And then we're going to take 1 cup of that mixed soil and put it in the bag provided by Extension. And it gets mailed to a testing service in Cropsey, Illinois, I believe.
Oh, wow.
And they send back this report. It's very detailed, and it tells you what your analysis is. So if you live on a timber soil lot and you're concerned about the number of oak trees dying on your property, this soil test could tell you why or why not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might not be that you have bad soil. It might not be related to that at all. It might be you live on high ground and the trees on high ground get struck by lightning often.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And those injuries are sometimes hard to see for tall, older trees. But if you are growing a lawn or a vegetable garden, you can share that with the testing facility and tell them that's what you're up to. You're wanting to test because you want to know where you're at, what your scorecard is. And
can you tell them, this is what I want to grow, this, this, and this, and can they tell you if your soil is going to support that well enough or not?
I think in the broadest category, yes. So
okay.
I'm growing a lawn, I'm growing a vegetable garden, I'm growing fruit trees, right? So there's 3 categories there.
Okay.
So if you wanted to do all 3, tell them you're doing all 3. So they have a way to get in touch with you, and they send you back this report.
Wait a minute. Do I get my dirt back?
You don't get your dirt back.
Okay.
You don't get it back.
All
but
right.
The good news is it's being created all the time, Laura. So
Hey, good point. Thank you.
Yeah. Yep. As things break down, they turn into dirt, right?
I love that.
Yeah. So you can send that test in, and then they send you back the results, either U.S. mail or in an email, and then you know where you're at. And then even if you're just curious because you bought a new piece of property, a new home, and you want to know where you're at, tell them that too. So you've got something that you can measure yourself against. If you need this or that, having this piece of paper is handy to take with you somewhere too. Say, hey, I'm trying to improve my lawn.
Mm-hmm.
I'm shopping for fertilizer. Can you help me with something with this nitrogen analysis, et cetera?
That is so cool. So go visit the Extension office in your community near you, and they'll be able to help you out with that. That would be very helpful to have a healthy yard. So next week here on GLT's Grow, we are going to welcome Nick and Lee from Nipagan Gardens and Greenhouses to talk about one of the most popular things to plant of all time. Tomatoes. Yes. Okay. And by the way, thanks so much for that on soil. That's very helpful. And if you've got a garden question or problem you'd like Murph to tackle, go to our website, submit it there. It's wglt.org/grow.
You can download the Grow podcast weekly at iTunes or at wglt.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT and wglt.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Black Panther has clawed its way to the top of the box office for a second week in a row. The highly anticipated new addition to the Marvel Cinematic Universe has earned over $700 million after just 12 days of release. The enthusiastic response isn't unusual for a superhero movie, but as the GLT Psych Geeks explain, Black Panther is giving audiences something they've never seen before. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
Black Panther is set in Africa, in the fictional country of Wakanda, the most technologically advanced nation on Earth. The film has a black director, Ryan Coogler, and a predominantly black cast featured in nuanced roles. Black Panther has the best Rotten Tomatoes score of any Marvel Cinematic Universe film, with a certified fresh rating at 97%. The film's success comes not just from the artistry of its creators, but from a need it's fulfilling. That's according to Scott Jordan and Eric Wesselman from the Illinois State University Department of Psychology. Jordan says you won't see Iron Man, Captain America, or Black Widow co-starring in this movie, and that is significant.
The movie is all about Wakanda, and it's told with zero intervention by any other Avengers. So it's Black Panther's story.
Center stage. Black Panther is center stage through the whole thing.
Yeah.
He is not a supporting character in this.
No.
Which is crucial.
No, it is crucial. And to follow the Marvel world, it'll play bigger roles in other stories down the road. I mean, it's being celebrated. Black director, all black cast. These are very real things. When you read through what some of the writers of past Black Panther arcs have had to say, particularly Ta-Nehisi Coates, it was all about creating 3D people. And Ta-Nehisi Coates is always asking himself about the characters, what would a person do in these circumstances? And then taking the writing cues from that position, as opposed to what would Captain America's sidekick do, right? Those are two different types of questions. And because the characters are addressed and written about from that human perspective, it's just a great story.
Eric, what kind of impact can this film have on audiences? Why is it important that audiences look up on the screen and see themselves up there? I mean, even though we're talking about superheroes here,
but
to see a reflection of one's own race up there, to see a reflection of one's own self up there, why is that important, Eric?
When we consume a text, whether it be reading a comic book or a novel or watching a film, one of the major functions is to empathize with that character, to perspective take, to identify in some way. And we as humans can certainly do that across social category lines. We're sort of hardwired to empathize. But decades of psychological data at this point show that we empathize or perspective take easiest with people who we see as similar to ourselves in various ways. And so to have a main character, a representation, a three-dimensional, real, authentic representation of yourself or of the category you identify with is just terribly important for not just the process of engaging in the film, but just seeing a positive view of people like you, right? It does wonders for self-esteem.
So does this type of storytelling give us a unique opportunity for empathy with white audiences going to see Black Panther?
It's just obvious that if one wants to use the phrase Black America and one wants to use the phrase White America, if one wants to use those phrases, it's clear that both of those identities are completely intertwined. And so to have characters like the end of Captain America Civil War, where it's Black Panther who's the forgiving one and doesn't kill the villain, and then you look at this and you see the wisdom of this character and the forgiveness in the character's qualities, it's simply good to see. It's for everyone. And some of the stuff we're dealing with, the things we hear in our political world these days are so terribly unforgiving, so terribly unsophisticated. So for the writers, the creators, to take the opportunity to perhaps remind us of what it's like to have forgiving, competent, complex public dialogue is for everybody, period.
Well, guys, this mainstreaming of diversity of these characters, are there any drawbacks to this? By mainstreaming the characters, are you going to be losing anything about what makes them significant?
Maybe we're changing what the mainstream is, right? In other words, when you read Nation Under Our Feet by Ta-Nehisi Coates, a recent Black Panther arc, Black Panther's a monarch. we don't do monarchs in the 21st century, right? So Ta-Nehisi Coates comes along and he problematizes being a monarch, and being the king is one of the central themes of Nation Under Our Feet, as long as they continue to get good writers, right? This is nothing but good, I would say. Yeah.
I mean, as a psychological scientist, I mean, I think the data suggests certainly for members of the underrepresented groups, having more diversity is good for them, but also for members of different social categories, having more diversity, more rich, authentic stories is only going to help increase our ability to empathize with each other across these lines. Yeah, so I think it's only a problem for people who view these sorts of issues as zero-sum games. There seem to be at least some internet trolls who view increased diversity as if it means that it's going to diminish their group, you know, but they're probably thinking of this as a zero-sum game, right? It's like whose group's on the top, but it's not about that. It's we're all in this together.
We just need to keep telling these stories. We just need to keep telling these more sophisticated stories. Eric's teaching a class on the psychology of comic books, and he invited me to come in a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things we talked about was that any in-group usually is an in-group because it has a well-defined out-group. And the question I had was, is it possible to tell a group story without an out-group? And the interesting thing is, and I'm not giving away any spoilers, but the next Avengers movie is Infinity. The Infinity Gauntlet, right? Or they're going to call it the Infinity War. Why? Because now there's a new out-group. It's not on Earth. It's from outside of Earth. It's Thanos. And you're going to see the Avengers and Black Panther all united against this common enemy. So even in the midst of the Earth coming together, there's still a clear, robust out-group.
Well, and you know, research on reducing intergroup tensions, intergroup conflict, they all have their different flavors and theoretical viewpoints, but they all converge on this general idea of changing the way we categorize ourselves, right? Not just us versus them, but we. You know, I suppose in Scott's point, yes, there always needs to potentially be another them. But
or
what
does
is,
there?
Or
that's
does
the
it?
Question,
well,
right?
And so actually that's a very good point.
Right.
So it could be a them, but the idea is one of superordinate goals, if you will. The idea that we have to cooperate to... We're interdependent,
right?
And so we need to survive. We need to increase, you know, the quality of life for everyone. And so, you know, that them, if you will, doesn't necessarily have to be a person. It could be a challenge, whatever that may be.
What if it's poverty? What if it's having everyone fed? What if it's having everyone educated? Mm-hmm. And those are the villains, right?
Yes.
And then we organize around that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the future. That's where the stories are going. And to be honest, that's where Black Panther, the movie, ends. These stories of inclusion simply need to be told and lived. That's how they become normalized. You know, Eric sent me a paper last week, Multiculturalism, Polyculturalism, and I don't remember what the first
one was. I think the other one was just what we would call colorblind approach.
Right. And it's different ways of looking at how cultures should interact. And the multiculturalists will argue that cultures need to all be provided their own space and that cultural fusion is not necessarily a good thing. Polyculturalists, on the other hand, seek fusion. I'm not here to say multicultural versus polycultural is right or wrong. What I'm saying is it's all here. And you're never going to be a polyculturalist and make a move and not have a multiculturalist tell you you're wrong. And vice versa. Multiculturalists are going to be told they're too uptight by polyculturalists. These things aren't going away. So as my kids say, just do you, right? Yeah. And learn how to take the heat. And hopefully you're telling stories you'll respect later in your life.
Well, right? And, you know, yeah, this idea from at least the psychological perspective, this idea of poly versus multiculturalism is pretty new. But what most of the data seem to support is that both are much better in terms of outcomes than colorblindness.
Yeah.
This idea, the rhetoric of I don't see difference, I don't see color, I don't see this, that, and the other. And that's most researchers would say, and the data support this, that that's just folly because we're all diverse. We all have differences that, you know, we want to, which that are part of our self-concepts that we need to celebrate. And so to pretend like they're not there, it doesn't work. As a matter of fact, it seems to show backlash, right? So there was this guy named Dan Wegner a couple decades ago did this study where he talked about cognitive suppression, if you will, where he's like, you know, getting people to try not to think about something, right? So the joke there was, don't think about the white bear. Don't think about the white bear. Don't think about the white bear, right? But what you saw in those studies is that the more someone tried to suppress, the more it just rebounded. For at least the studies that I've seen, for people who try to take the colorblind approach, they're shooting themselves in the foot because it just means that their biases are going to boomerang back even stronger.
That's GLT's Psych Geeks, Scott Jordan and Eric Wesselman from the Illinois State University Department of Psychology. The success of Black Panther has prompted a call from the top lobbyist for the motion picture exhibition industry for Hollywood to follow the money and produce even more diverse movies. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The film has been out for less than 2 weeks, and there's already talk about the inevitable sequel. Grammy-winning artist and Black Panther superfan Kendrick Lamar has expressed a desire to portray the arch supervillain. From the soundtrack, here's Wakanda, composed by Ludwig Göransson, and you're listening to it on Sound Ideas. Music from the film Black Panther. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal with help today from Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, and Charlie Schlenker. Find the full show podcast and individual stories and interviews at WGLT.org. Try the NPR One app for GLT and NPR News. Get the app from Google Play or the Apple App Store. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. You can even call and leave a message about Sound Ideas at 309-438-WGLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.